Okay, let's begin. We're starting now part two. We started from 1840, and we finished around 1900. We finished off by talking about the first chassid in Los Angeles, the great grandson of the Baal HaTanya, Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson, who gave a shir on Maarat HaMachpelah here. And there is stuff out there on him. I think received after the shir, received a couple emails of people who had heard about him and had information about him and who he was. Let's continue the story. My thesis, the first part, was that America, LA, Los Angeles, was developed in many parts by Jews who had come overseas, who had come to Los Angeles to try something new in their lives, and they had gotten involved in building Los Angeles right from the get-go. And some of the names of things we take for granted were actually Jews who did it here in Los Angeles and took a role in leadership. They were the only ones who were trusted with money. They were the ones who were the most educated. And we talked about those early Jewish settlers here, and I called it Orthodox because at that time there was no denomination. You came, the Judaism, all you had was the Judaism that was in your pocket. That's it. There was nothing more, nothing less, and that's what you started with. So let's continue. The turn of the 1900s brings amazing change to America as a whole, and certainly for Los Angeles. If you want to get an idea of the size right now, we're talking about 100,000 people are right now in Los Angeles. You have a rapid growth in popularity of Venice, a great site. There's some great pictures out there on the turn of the century, people going to Venice. That was one of the few recreations that you had, locations and destinations to go to in Los Angeles. There's a building of a rapid transit system, which is going to help the migration west. You have a brilliant Irish engineer, not Jewish. We saw that Van Nuys was Jewish. A brilliant Irish engineer whose name was William Mulholland comes to Los Angeles at the time. He figures out how to channel water across the desert and over a mountain and into the San Fernando Reservoir. That's ultimately going to allow a growth of people and Jews moving into different areas, and areas that we call the Valley. Another innovative design at this time becoming popular is the airplane. Airplane shows are going to be, helicopter shows are going to be something of interest to people in Los Angeles at the turn of the century. So much going on in Los Angeles that the population is going to triple in a decade to 320,000 people. Now let's talk about the Jews. Jewish population goes from 2,500 in the year 1900 to 20,000 by 1920. They might have been a small group, but they were extremely visible. The new influx of immigrants start moving to an area we're going to get to next week, which takes place at B'nai David. They move to Boyle Heights. We're going to talk about the Boyle Heights era. The majority of the 1900s immigration were, in fact, by the way, at the early 1900s, they were Orthodox, at least in belief, if it wasn't in practice. The new immigrants brought with them Yiddish as well to Los Angeles. We talked about how as the pioneering Jews in the 50s and 60s helped build commercial Los Angeles, a handful of Jews in the beginning of the 20th century are going to actually change the world. So they start by changing Los Angeles, and then they're going to go ahead and change the world. And their impact is largely disproportionate to the amount of people that got here. What is this group that changes the world? So there are a group of immigrants coming mostly from Russia. And it starts with a pioneer of the motion picture industry, one of the pioneers, whose name was William Selig. He sends his favorite director of this new industry, whose name was Francis Boogs. He sends him to Los Angeles in 1907 to complete a film called The Count of Monte Cristo. He didn't send him to Los Angeles because of the weather, but a bigger reason. This is going to affect us. The bigger reason is that in Los Angeles, you could stay ahead of the race as far as needing permits and the governmental enforcements of where you could film, locations to film. It was still very much Hefker in California and specifically Los Angeles, which allowed you beautiful scenes, beautiful sets, without having to worry about a lot of the red tape. Entrepreneurial and opportunity hungry Jews jump right into the mix. The Three Stooges, the Marx Brothers, Sam Goldfish, later Goldwyn, Adolf Zucker, Jewish writers, lawyers, producers, Jews ran the most powerful talent agencies, Carl Amel, William Fox, Louis B. Mayer, Benjamin Warner, all of them had basically the same upbringing. raised in poverty in Eastern Europe and anxious to break free from that world. So the beginning of Jewish life in Los Angeles, or Jewish history in Los Angeles, develops around an impulse to break free from the Judaism. So in a sense, Orthodoxy's history in Los Angeles starts with a culture and a group of people who want to run away from their Orthodoxy. But they can't entirely escape it. And I'm going to show you why. I want to use Adolf Zucker as an example. Adolf Zucker gets involved in the movie industry in 1903 when his cousin Max Goldstein comes to him for a loan in order to expand some theaters he has in Buffalo, New York. The loan turns out to pay off because it's a great investment, and they decide to open up more theaters together. In 1912, Adolf Zucker establishes the famous Players Film Company. Afterwards, he evolves and changes to a new company after leaving Manhattan. When he comes to California, he starts something called, you may have heard of it, Paramount Pictures. That's Adolf Zucker. Now, where does his Orthodoxy play a role? He's born in a small Hungarian village. His father dies while he's in infancy, and his mother a few years later. He's sent off to an uncle nearby. The uncle is learning Yomam Valayla, day and night. That's all he does. It's not a lot of attention. It's not a parent. It's a figure in his life of someone who just learns. His name was Kalman Lieberman, was the name of his uncle. Loved studying the Talmud, loved studying Gemara. Religion was his entire life. Adolf Zucker said later in his life, he didn't like the discussions and the detailed nuance of the Talmud that his uncle made him sit through. But he loved that the head of his school, or his cheder, knew that Zucker, young Adolf Zucker, didn't like Gemara. And he used to pull him aside to his office to learn with him stories of the Bible, stories of the Chumash, stories of Tanakh. Zucker said later on, those stories got his imagination going. The possibility of thinking beyond the little shtetl, of realizing that while you're here in Eastern Europe, your mind could be transported to Jews crossing through the water, leaving outside of Egypt. So in a sense, the Orthodox background and upbringing, the idea of dreaming and the vision that the Chumash laid out, would in a sense have an impact in Adolf Zucker's development of Paramount Picture. They wanted to reject their past so badly, this group of Jewish people. MGM, founded by our Louis B. Mayer, he erased his birth date as to symbolize I'm starting over. We assume Zucker abandoned Judaism as well. But listen to this twist in the plot. Zucker's son, Eugene, found in his closet a bag. He looked in the bag and realized it was some religious artifact. What was in the bag? In the bag was a prayer shawl, a talis, and the straps, which were tefillin. The amazing thing is that the talis and the tefillin bag were not found in the back of his closet, filled with dust, but they were found in his father Adolf Zucker's closet at the front of his closet. Not there stored with boxes, but with the things he accesses most, as though he would put on his tefillin from time to time. He said that his father used to speak about Shmuel Rosenberg, who was this Rebbe in the Cheder, who fascinated him with stories of Rebbes and Tanakh and all these imaginative ideas that would get his creative juices flowing. For more on Adolf Zucker's life and others like him, you have to read Neil Gabler's A World of Their Own. Look at religious life for the Warner Brothers. Their father, Benjamin, was extremely religious. Moral, he was anti-assimilation, he hammered home Torah values, ran a Shabbos table, told it to the children over and over. Now that orthodoxy would end up splitting the family, because some of the children loved it, and the other children who couldn't keep up or didn't like it, felt there was a competition and their father had favorites. So you have half the family running away, half the family pursuing some affiliation, and that led to the famous fights that existed among the Warner Brothers family in the development of the Warner Brothers. So in a sense, Orthodoxy is not shaping in LA by Judaica stores in the beginning of the 1900s, or even major shuls, but it's shaping in LA almost in an incidental way. First, we saw last week that the early settlers are coming. They want to get involved. Their Judaism teaches them to get involved, to be responsible, to be educated. That's shaping LA. And what we're seeing now, LA is being shaped by people running from orthodoxy, fighting over their orthodoxy, hiding their orthodoxy, being creative because of their Judaism, because of their orthodoxy. This struggle of identity versus originality versus assimilation comes to a crescendo, comes to a climax in one movie, 1927, an American musical film called The Jazz Singer. Cantor Jackie Rabinowitz changing his name to Jack Robin. When you see that movie in isolation, okay, it's an interesting movie that resonates maybe with people we know or distant family members. But when you think about it in the context of what was happening in Los Angeles at the time, this was Judaism in Los Angeles, trying to hold on to an old world that's slipping away very quickly, unraveling at the seams. And the child who's trying to be loyal to the parent, but at the same time, loyal to their own will to express themselves in this new world. This was Los Angeles. This was Hollywood. This was orthodoxy in Los Angeles. This was Judaism. This is where it would begin to move. And the movie starring Al Jolson with the six songs, we know the classic story. So the Jews are involved and are, in a sense, running Hollywood. There's a lot that's been written lately, and you have to read up on the fact of whether Hollywood was aware of the Nazis' influence in the 1930s and what the Jews in Hollywood did to infiltrate and watch the Nazis' control. There's a lot been written. The LA Times wrote something about it last year. That's not for now. The Christian community in Los Angeles looked around and they say to themselves, wait a second, we're being infiltrated by Jews everywhere. Jews are taking over stores, kosher-style restaurants are opening up, and suddenly the Hollywood Jews become proud enough to open up the first Hollywood shul. Beth El opens up. Why is this bothering the Christians? It's bothering the Christians because they see the Jew as an element looking to undermine conservative religious values in LA. Here they're building this industry called Hollywood, which so much of it is going to go against good old-fashioned Christian values. And the influence of the Jews coming into LA is beginning to create some friction. Now back to the shul. Remember what was the first shul in LA we said? Was B'nai B'rith, which later becomes Wilshire Temple. They bring in a dynamic 25-year-old. One probably, as far as standards, as far as impact in LA per se, is probably one of the most significant rabbis in LA. Not Orthodox, but as far as his impact. His name is Rabbi Edgar Magnin. When he comes onto the scene, the community is divided into three groups. German Jews, they're the predominant group, the preeminent group. They control the money, the power, the status. There are the Russian Jews, by and large, more religious, Yiddish speaking. They stayed away from the rush. The Germans didn't want to do with the Russians. The Russians didn't want anything to do with the Germans. But you have a third group who are a hybrid. These Eastern European Jews who are successful Hollywood Jews. They're making money, but they don't have the civility of the German Jews. So you understand, you have three classes of Jews developing. Why am I telling you the story of Rabbi Magnin, a Reform rabbi, in a series on the history of Orthodox Judaism? Because in June 1920, Rabbi Magnin forms the Hillcrest Country Club, purchasing 142 acres in Beverly Hills. Hillcrest would be the only nexus point for all the Jews in LA. Whether you were German Jews or you were the Hollywood Jew, that's where you found a place where you could sit together. That leaves one group totally out of the loop. That's the Orthodox Jew, the religious Jew. So what's the religious Jew going to do? They can't hang out on Sunday. They don't fit in. They don't have the money. They're not going to sit and fit in with the groups that are sitting at the Hillcrest Country Club, the Hoi Polloi German group, and they don't fit in with the Knockers in Hollywood. So where are they going to fit in? They put their energies into causes and eventually philanthropy. Caspar Cohn was a Hellman son-in-law. Remember, Hellman, I said, was the big money in LA. Caspar Cohn develops a hospital. That hospital would later become Cedars-Sinai. Cedars-Sinai. Orthodox were very much a part of its initial development. The Hebrew Home for the Aged was Orthodox run. You look at the pictures that we have in the archives of the Hebrew Home for the Aged, it's all yarmulkes. There's many pictures of lulavim. They loved, for some reason, Sukkot was a big time to take pictures at the Hebrew Home for the Aged. A lot of the pictures we have on file are with the etrog, with the lulav. That's what we have. 1911, the Federation of Jewish Charities. 1930, Jewish Orphans Home. Rabbi Magnum is the spokesman for Judaism in Los Angeles. Whether you were Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, the voice to the public for you was Rabbi Magnum. That was it at the time. Now, back to our game show. If we're on a game show and they ask you the name of the first Orthodox shul in Los Angeles, purely Orthodox shul, that appears in 1892. The name of the shul is called Beth Israel, or the Olive Street Synagogue. Opens in 1892. They hold services in a place, McDowell Hall, and they bring in their first Orthodox rabbi. So now, who is the first Orthodox officiating rabbi in Los Angeles for our game show? We spoke about Rabbi Adelson last week. He's the first rabbi in Los Angeles. The first, I would say, fully Orthodox rabbi was a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Isaac Verne, W-E-R-N-E. He becomes the first religious leader of the congregation. He stays for 6 years, leaves, and then comes back in 1930. Comes back in 1930 after leaving to the Midwest. His name was also originally Vernikovsky. So on his kever, on his matseva, which you can see online, on his matseva, you have both names in case they were a family was afraid someone would misrepresent the history or not know who was who. So you have Verna and you have Vernikovsky on both sides. He was also a rabbi in Columbus, Ohio, and he served his congregation. We don't know how much he knew or didn't know. You can only tell how big of a Talmud. The way to tell how big of a Talmud Chacham is, the best you could do is one, stories, and number two, the Sfarim that they produce. We don't have anything from him. We just know that he was our first shul rabbi in Los Angeles. Who's the first Talmud Chacham to live in Los Angeles? Now, the first Talmud Chacham to walk in, we already said, was Reb Chaim Tzvi Schneerson. And you could put on the list the one who knew Tanakh by heart. We said Carvajal, who was the artist, who was the painter, the photographer for the mission, for the expeditions we talked about. The John Fremont's expeditions. He knew Tanakh inside out. But a real Talmud Chacham in the sense that we're used to, the first one was someone by the name of Rabbi Jacob Bauman. Rabbi Jacob Bauman is the name, the first name. He's going to become one of the founders of the Jewish Home for the Aged. But let's talk about Rabbi Yaakov Bauman. He's born in 1878 in Poland. In his youth, he studies under Rabbi Avram Borenstein. Anybody know that is? That the Sogachover Rebbe, the great Sogachover Rebbe. He gets smicha from the Sogachover Rebbe's star student. At the age of 25, he gets smicha from Rabbi Avram Yitzchak of Zagrov, who was one of the great Talmidim of the Sogachover Rebbe. 1907, he comes to Los Angeles, where he's the rabbi of a shul, Agudas Achim, for 2 years, and then a congregation, Talmud Torah, for 3 years, and of a shul called Shari Torah, until the end of his life. What's his story? And it's an interesting one. He marries a young, wealthy woman whose name was Frimit Danziger. I have to thank, by the way, much of the details of this story I have was because Rebbetzin Hutler, alayhi shalom, was collecting some of the Orthodox history in L.A. shortly before she passed. Her husband gave me all her documents and everything she had, and she had some fascinating interviews. There's an interview with the first caterer in Los Angeles, which hopefully we'll get to. So Frimit Danziger marries, a young wealthy woman, Frimit Danziger marries Jacob Bauman. It's a great shidduch because he's considered the top, one of the top in his yeshiva. They have several children. One of their children, Sam, is born club-footed and was not in the best of health. Rabbi Bauman goes to a Mr. Nelkin, a wealthy Jewish farmer, to help him get an emergency horse and coach to take his son quickly on Shabbos for emergency treatment. And he helps. But after being in the hospital for a year straight, the family burns through all the money they had. He realizes he's stuck. What's he going to do? All he's trained in is to learn and to be a big Talmud Chacham. He was told that in Frankfurt there are no positions, but go check New York. He has no money, but people of Frankfurt feel bad for him and they gladly pay for his trip to New York. in New York. He stayed for a few years. Any penny, like now, if you ever go to New York, many of the cab drivers are people who left their entire family. Any dollar they make, they put it aside and send it back to Senegal, send it back to North Africa, wherever they could send money back to their family. That's what Rabbi Bauman was doing, trying to get whatever he could to send money back to his family, back for his son. While there in New York, he meets a guy in Shul whose name was Morris. Morris introduces himself, and talk about Hashgacha Pratis. Morris's last name is Danziger. Turns out Morris Danziger is the brother of his wife, who he didn't know he was even meeting in New York, and the family didn't know was in New York. He knew this was Hashgacha Pratis, this happened for a reason. Morris Danziger said, I'm just visiting, I really live in Los Angeles. You gotta come to Los Angeles. There's tremendous opportunity there. 3 months later, he makes arrangements to come. While on the train, he gets off at a certain stop so he can send a telegram to his brother-in-law when he plans to get there and where to pick me up. He looks back at the station and realizes, uh-oh, the train left with his talis, his tefillin, everything he had. Everything he had with him, he left. Western Union Telegraph Station at the time helps him, and he ultimately is going to recover it a few weeks later when he gets to Los Angeles. You think, now we go online and we click in the app, recover your lost stuff, and someone brings it to you 2 minutes later and tracks it. Then it must have been extremely unnerving to know that you're going to a world that you've never seen before, to understand that you have no money, that you have nothing, and then to understand that you've lost everything, the few things that you do have. He comes to Los Angeles and he meets a Mr. Pollock who knows how to shecht. They together are going to become the first shochtim in Los Angeles, Mr. Pollock and Rabbi Jacob Bauman. They open up a butcher shop on the southwest corner of 1st and Alameda. In 1910, the Bauman family was finally able to be brought over. Now imagine the mother, imagine Freeman, traveling by herself with a child who couldn't walk. They end up at Ellis Island and couldn't speak a word of English and nobody there to receive them. It's a mess for them in New York for 3 or 4 days till finally someone is able to bring them and help them get to Los Angeles. How does Rabbi Bauman make a living and help for his son's care? So he meets a nephew of the owner of the Manischewitz Matzah Company to sell matzahs. That's a start. But here comes his boom. It's in Indio. 1912, he orders a lulav and esrog from New York. It makes it over in time for Sukkot, but one problem. It's been crushed in the cargo. He realizes that nobody has a lulav and esrog in LA. It's almost impossible to get. You always hear those tshuvas of the one person in town with the brisker rav. Should they give it to the rav? Who gets to shake it first? All those tshuvas. And you wonder, where does this ever take place? It happened in LA. There was no lulav and esrog in 1912 in LA. He thought he would have the only one in Los Angeles. He says, I'm not going to let this stop happen ever again. He opens up, he's the first mass producer of lulavim in Los Angeles. It happens in Indio, California. He goes from matzahs to lulavim, and he's one of the first producers and manufacturers of kosher wine. Why does he do so well in the kosher wine business? Listen to this. 1918, prohibition goes into effect. There's one major exception in the laws of prohibition: religious reasons. Jews are granted that exception of religious reasons, and they're given the ability to use they're given the right and the privilege to keep the wine. He's making hundreds and hundreds of dollars selling wine. Everybody was suddenly Jewish at that point when it came to getting wine. What happens at the same time is a brandy hijacking fiasco. And the IRS confiscates everything from him as well. They go on the hit and they wipe out everyone. He would win everything back and more in a huge lawsuit in Los Angeles, of which we have all the records of. I was able to get from UCLA. You could even find a mention of the records online. A major legal battle he won, where the lawyer, a non-Jew, an Irishman, went to his defense, thought this was a great case, and the IRS had to compensate him for all the lost time that he couldn't sell wine, not just the wine they took, but the lost potential parnassa that he lost in between. He was really able to stop selling after that wine and just learn for his rest of his time in LA. They needed a larger home as the kids were growing up. They moved to the west side of town instead of Boyle Heights. Finally, their last place in LA is Detroit, and then they rent a house on 127 South Martell. Who is that now? Across the street from us. 127 South Martell. They open a shul called Shara Torah on the corner of Martell and Beverly. Shara Torah would move back a few blocks and become what shul? Anybody know? Not Shara Tefillah. Etz Jacob. Etz Jacob. The name is going to stay on Beverly Shara Tefillah. We'll get there. But it becomes Etz Jacob. It's the first Orthodox minyan in the Fairfax district. Now, Rabbi Hutler lamented the fact that he said his sons must have thrown everything out. Rabbi Bauman's tshuvas, Rabbi Bauman's letters, everything. With all due respect, that's not true. Dr. Steve Weiss, who lives on the other side of town in Los Angeles, was able to give me a diary that he had from Rabbi Bauman, a copy of his sefer, and two svarim that have since been loaded now onto HebrewBooks.org. He has a sefer called Chemdas Yaakov, put out by his children. Now listen to this. The children write in the preface in English. The publication of this book, Chemdas Jacob, was the great desire of our illustrious father, Rabbi Jacob Bauman of blessed memory. To this book, which contains many treatises and commentaries on Talmudical subjects, so on and so forth, our father of blessed memory was occupied practically day and night with answering the many questions relating to problems of everyday Jewish life. You wonder who is asking, who was there to ask those questions? But now look at this tshuva. We have a letter of responsa from him. He says, the question, he gives the date for when he asked it, Kavod Yedid Hashem, right? Yedid Hashem, a friend of God, and a friend of Israel, and a friend of mine. Who's he hanging out with? Who's his friend? Who's he calling my friend? Harav Hagadol Ubekia, Hagon Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski Shlita. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, probably the greatest, one of, if not the greatest Talmud Chacham of the last century, one of the greatest poskim in the history of the Jewish people. Rabbi Jacob Bauman was a contemporary of his, was a friend of his, a yedid, called him a friend of his. Now what does he write to him? It must be something pressing that was facing the community. I looked at the tshuva. You know what it's about? It's a technical question about the status of mazik hektish, if someone damages a consecrated animal to the Beis HaMikdash. Why? You have Rabbi Chaim Moser Grzynski's ear, and you're asking him about mazik hektish? You know why? How does it feel when you're the only Talmud Chacham in Los Angeles? You're the only one who spends day and night learning. Your mind is surrounded by the folios of the Talmud, every page of the Gemara, and you're waiting just to have a back and forth with the great people that you remember in Eastern Europe. You're not going to waste your time with a question of matzah on the first night versus matzah on the second night. You're going to spend it deep in the questions that are keeping you up at night, that keeps the Talmud Chacham up, the sugya that he's learning on his own. So he's trying to keep up his learning with those overseas. There's some amazing tshuvas over here. Poe, to hear and see in writing at that time, Poe Los Angeles, that he's writing to Gavriel Zev Margolius. Who's Gavriel Zev Margolius? Those from the East Coast may know him. Av based in Be'er, New York. His name stands for Ramaz. The school Ramaz on the east side of Manhattan is named after him. Rabbi Haskell Lukstein, the great Rav in Manhattan, is the grandson of the Ramaz who he was writing to at the time. A question on the Kesef Mishnah and the Rambam, again, wasn't really mainly, the children thought these were questions pertaining to Halacha Lamaisa. I was looking at the majority of these pages. These are questions of Pilpul. He wants to learn. He wants to be alive in his learning, and there's nobody around. And it's a beautiful, they're beautiful, but it's in a sense, it's a tragic story for Rabbi Bauman, the frustration that he feels at the time. But we don't know. It could be those are great years for him. But as far as the letters, you see that he had a longing to converse in Halacha and Talmud with the Gaonim of Eastern Europe. Let's take a sidestep now and talk about what's going on with the Sephardi community. Where are the Sephardim in all this? So for that, we go back to the expulsion, 1492. The Jews at that point are going to migrate, Sephardi Jews are going to migrate all over, all through the Ottoman Empire. It's going to include Turkey, Rhodes, Greece, some of the Slavic states, most of North Africa. They went to Holland, some going to India, China, even Japan. They're going to look for a home. They're expelled from England. That's why you don't hear about Jews in England during that time. They're expelled from England by Edward I. Jews set up shop and have a cultural revolution in Madrid. Jews land in America as early as 1654, when a handful of 23 of them arrive from Brazil, New Amsterdam, present-day New York City. They're rejected initially by the governor. Anyone know the governor for the Daily Double? Who's the governor of New York at the time?
Stuyvesant.
Peter Stuyvesant wants the Jews out of town. Get out of here. Why do they not leave? Why are they able to stay? Because the Dutch West India Company was run by some very influential Jews. Stuyvesant's funding for his government was coming from trades with the Dutch West India Company. They said, no, no, you're going to allow the Jews to stay in New York. Jews, though, the agreement was they can't fight in the military. Usher Levy wants to fight in the military. He's not allowed. The government says no. Steps in the West India Company once again and says, we'll stop trading with you unless you let the Jews fight in your army. Usher Levy becomes the first Jewish soldier in America. First Jewish soldier in America. We talked about the first Jew to come into, first Sephardic Jew. By the way, if you want to know the name of who we think was the first Jew at all in Los Angeles, it was one of the names of the list I read you from the manifesto. The first one we think to step foot in Los Angeles was Jacob Frankfurt, who was a tailor. We think he was the first. The first Sephardi, who I mentioned last week, was Salomon Nunez Carvajal, who was the photographer and painter with Fremont's expedition. I told you about the Labatt brothers who had come. They're the first Jews born, the first Sephardi Jews born in America. Say it better. They're the first Jews born in America to live in Los Angeles. You understand that? They weren't born in Los Angeles, but they're the first Jews in America to live in Los Angeles. They open up a store called La Tienda de China, right? Probably like some thrift store of some sort that they open up, what's the equivalent of probably downtown. They leave Los Angeles. There aren't lots of opportunities. And between 1850 and the 20th century, we know of only one Sephardic Jew in the Los Angeles area. Talk about lonely, the lonely man of faith. His name was David de Ancona, who traveled from San Diego up to Los Angeles. Rabbi Dr. William Kramer put together a story and tried to put together whatever he could about this mysterious David de Ancona, the lonely Sephardi, to write something we know about him. The first Sephardi congregation put together from Jews, Sephardi Jews who were Turkish and Rhodesian. The name of the congregation was Congregation Avat Shalom, 1912. They rent space in some members' homes. Their first spiritual leader is Rabbi Avraham Karako. Rabbi Avraham Karako. 52 families in the congregation, 37 in Rhodes, and that is the opening shul. Of course, with Jews, there's going to be a breakaway. The first breakaway happened for our game show. What's our first breakaway? Our first breakaway is 1917. The Rhodesians don't like all these other Sephardi Jews mixing in, messing with our minhagim, and they form the Peace and Progress Synagogue with Chacham Chaim Levy serving as the spiritual leader, and the first president, the first Sephardi president in LA was Moshe or Morris Soriano, who's the first Sephardi president in Los Angeles. We don't know a whole lot about Rabbi Avraham Karako. If anyone is able to find any information about him, I ask you, you can't dig deep to look for it. I've been looking for any. It wasn't a tradition in the 1800s and 1900s for Sephardi scholars to write things down. Sfarim was not their business. Whether they weren't near the printing press or it wasn't in vogue, they didn't write down. That's why we don't have a lot of Chidushei Torah in those years from the Temani, the Yemenites as well, and from the Sephardic community as well. There was lots of migration. The communities were business-focused. There wasn't the concept of massive amounts of learners, so there wasn't a market for all the Sfarim, so we don't have lots of Chidushei Torah in general. But if anyone is able to find those, that would, of course, be of great assistance. So this boom that we're talking about, and we're now in a few places at once, I realize that. We're talking about the city booming. People are going to Venice. They're coming to Los Angeles for opportunity. That boom of the 1920s would come to an abrupt end in 1929 with the Wall Street crash. Los Angeles would be impacted severely. 1932 Olympics come to Los Angeles to attempt to bring some cheer. And all of this, how does Los Angeles respond? Everybody had to respond in some way to the Wall Street crash. Some communities resorted to crime. Some communities still were able to maintain the status quo, Los Angeles went in a different direction. What was that? You have a boom at that time in the wake of the Wall Street crash. Los Angeles becomes the home of metaphysics, yoga, and vegetarianism. The name La La Land probably was going to be developed for LA in the 1930s. To respond to the fact that there's simply not enough money and resources, Los Angelinos found it as a spiritual oasis or a place for a spiritual awakening. It became, Southern California became an alternative city. It was a pot of gold at the end of a tunnel, people hoping to fight their way out of depression. The drought, which comes in August of America 1935, in the Dust Bowl of America, brings a wave of immigrants from Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Texas. They're illiterate, they're angry, and they're poor. You have the bursting of the California Dam in 1928 in San Francisco, and you have the earthquake in Long Beach in 1933. Those three elements creating poverty, lack of education, and an anger with their lives and a frustration is going to create one of the world's favorite pastimes in Los Angeles. Anti-Semitism comes finally to Los Angeles right in the 1930s. The Hellmans, who were the great titans, I said they were the highest paying property tax in the entire country, the Hellmans are all but wiped out financially. Jews make a shift in the 1930s, and they get heavily involved in combating anti-Semitism and standing at the forefront of Zionist causes. What I want to look at next week is a new growing community in Los Angeles, which was a very unique experiment in the history of Judaism as a whole, for Orthodox to thrive and acclimate themselves in a neighborhood that was surrounded by so many different cultures and integrate well with them. That's the community of the Boyle Heights. It's going to introduce us to some amazing figures. We're going to talk about the Clevelander Rebbe and many other Hasidic Rebbes and rabbis who lived in that area at the time, and a very interesting and unique population, and why ultimately they left Boyle Heights and didn't stay there. That's all for tonight. We'll end there.